have to thank everyone for coming. If you take a look on your page 2, there's a scenario that I call combat zone. And we'll look at that one and then go back to picture perfect for a moment. Here's the story. Sometimes in the dating situation, one or the other cannot pinpoint what's bothering them. It's still like a vague feeling, you know. In this particular case, what happens is, okay, the names here that are given are David and Batya, I mean, again, the names are irrelevant. But on their fourth date, David says over a Dvar Torah. He's interested in that Dvar Torah. It means a lot to him. And Batya immediately responds, "That's not right. How do I know it's wrong? Because I heard from my rabbi just the opposite." And he gets this feeling that she's combative. You know, she wants to fight with him. She's not maybe going to be the type of wife that we call it a yes man, or in this case a yes woman, that's going to shake her head yes on everything that her husband says and rah, 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 you know, right on, you know. So he gets this vague feeling of maybe it's not, if you didn't get this, please take one. I think I gave it out, but no. I never know if you brought it or not. Now, you know, when we talk about sensitivities, and we've discussed this in the past, you know, heart sensitivities and his, David in this case is sensitive for two reasons. First of all, because he put a lot of passion into this Dvar Torah. You know, he expected to get some sort of positive response. So that itself makes him a bit sensitive. But moreover, he's worried about the following. Perhaps she's not going to respect him. You know, he comes with his Torah. A man always feels that he's going to be the posek in the house. You know, he's the authority. And here his wife is questioning him. And she doesn't pull any punches. You know, she's right there. What would you say about this? You know, should he drop it? You know, it's only the fourth date. But the fourth date is the fourth date. You know, to push it longer if he thinks it's really time to throw in the towel, I don't think we'd be doing justice neither to himself nor, and certainly not to Batya in this case. Any response?
Question, Rabbi, do you guys have any questions?
Anybody feel? What do you think David should be doing here? Should he throw in the towel again? It doesn't seem to be anything else that bothers him. Just that.
Yeah, talk to her rav.
Okay, that's one thing you can do. Talk to her rav. But what if her rav says to him the following? Just again, because I'm just trying to push it to know whether you think this is like the end. You know, the break is here. What if the rav says that's her personality? You know, she likes to go for a fight. You know, she has an opinion, and she heard a different view, and therefore, you know. So in a certain sense, her rabbi confirms his suspicion that this nakuda, as we say, you know, this point in their relationship is going to be less than what he, you know, he envisioned in his dream of marriage.
I mean, it just sounds like the beginning of a conversation. We don't know where it's going. I'm not saying I'd be so objective in the situation, but I might say, well, let's hear what you're up to say. And then maybe the truth is that it's a machlokes tanoim, or there's a machlokes tanoim.
You see, that's it. Myron sees it from a Londonship perspective. You know, there's so many different views on any Torah issue that why not? You know, she has what she got from Havasora. You know, you can see the whole thing here. You know, he's going to say, well, I come from Basil, she comes, you know, it can really be fun. But I think, Raboso, what we're really touching on here is a much larger question about dating and marriage. And that is what is the basic approach to marriage? Are we looking for a certain overall experience, you know, in which we look at a woman, she looks at a man, and we see many, many different things? Are we going to pinpoint X, Y, or Z and say, well, these are non-negotiables, as we'll see?
That depends. if you, let's say, uber Hasidish, and she has a litvak, you know, opinion.
You might see that as steering for trouble.
It's
right.
Kind of like a chesed emes kind of paradox. You know? When she burns the dinner, do you lie and say it was wonderful, or do you tell the truth and say?
That's a good question. I have to add that to the scenarios. I mentioned the name Rabbi Ben Zion Shafir. He's a Talmud of Rav Chanoch Leibovitz, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Chafetz Chaim back in Queens, New York. And he, as I mentioned, has an organization called Shmooze. That's what he started. But through this organization, he had exposure to young people who were dating, to married couples who were having issues. And he comes to the table with a lot of experience. In this particular scenario called the combat zone, he has a lot to say. And I feed it to you, we'll read it together as, you know, food for thought. You know, we can decide that, you know, like Batya in the story, we don't accept what he says, or we can accept what he says. But I think there's something to be thinking about here, and this you'll find on your page 7. So turn, if you will, to page 7, and we'll see what he has to say, what the rabbi has to say. Please.
It could be that she's actually responding to something that he said, and since he said it in the way that he said it, she's just actually kind of reflecting that on a subjective level.
Maybe he was a little bit too forceful about the way he said it. Men have the tendency of being very forceful about what they say. Especially, you see that this David, he has a little bit of an issue of who's going to be the authority. You know, so if he's trying to impress her by saying, again, in this case it's Dvar Torah, but it could be a political opinion, it could be some insight that he has into sociology or what's going on in contemporary life, it could be anything. If he says it with a little bit too much oomph, maybe it sounded a little bit conceited. She responded to that and she fought with him. But let's leave combat zone on the side. I almost see it now as a catalyst, because I really want to show you a presentation here about dating. And it comes up in marriage as well. It's not just dating, which I think really touches on the core of how we have to go about finding a marriage partner. And once again, I say by introduction, I'm just presenting the view of Rabbi Shafir. I'm not, you know, I never met the man. I don't know him. He sounds very, very experienced and very polished. But I would like to, you know, share this with you. There's a copy over there. Yitz, you want to, just to follow it inside. We're on page 7. Now, he presents two tests. When I say test, I don't mean an exam in the sense that, you know, he or she is meant to test the other one. You know, that's not what we're talking about. But what are the parameters? How should we go about trying to find a marriage partner? The first test he calls the paper test. And the second one he calls the Basher test. Yeah, we can give different names to this, but these are the names that he gives. He says the following. It's clear that in dating, we pinpoint certain personality traits. And we ponder them. You know, after a good long date, we come home, we start thinking, you know, that she... Again, I'll say it in a she here because of the case that we have. You know, Batya displays a certain personality trait. Now, he may have seen this before, but the point is he has to ask himself, what is his criterion for finding a marriage partner? We're talking about a long-term relationship. So does this personality trait, which, assuming he's seen it recur a number of times, if he only saw it once, he could probably, you know, put it on the side, continue dating, but after a while, if it recurs, he can definitely pinpoint it as this young lady's personality. So here's what he has to say. He wants to use an approach which starts with the paper test. You'll see this on the left column It's approximately the sixth paragraph down. Here, we're looking objectively. We have a list of what we think he or she thinks are the traits, the qualities that go into finding a marriage partner. Now, if you've made your list and on paper everything seems to work out, you know, she has all the qualities that he's looking for, at least on paper, and we'll talk about later on what we should be looking for, but he's got his list. So she passed the first test. When we say the first test, what we're referring to are the basics. Okay? What are the basics? What do I need? You know, what are the interests that we share? What are the personality traits? Now we get to a little bit of the second test. And that he calls the Basher test. Objectively, things check out. Again, you don't have to have a shopping list like when you go to buy it. But you have some sort of a mental vision or an image of who your marriage partner should be. Things check out. Now we're ready to move on. We get to the Basher test. The Basher test says the following. That Hashem has sent you this woman. And if he did, that means she passed the Basher test. Now you're ready for a serious relationship. But how do you know that she's your Basher? So he says the following. Once she's passed the paper test, then at this level, all he has to figure out is whether he finds her attractive, whether he finds her personality compatible to his. Does he feel comfortable with her? Is he looking forward to the next date? Is the relationship developing? Those are the critical questions. He's never going to find a woman who is exactly like him. Again, halavai, you should find a woman who checks off every single minute detail. She has every single personality trait you'd ever dream of. There are personality differences that are almost by definition built into any relationship. She comes from her personality, her background, he comes from his. There are going to be issues. But the question is, has she passed both tests? Take a look at his language. I think we should read it in thought. On the top of the right column, okay, this girl has the qualities that you want. You know, she passed, as we said, all the paper tests. But now we're ready for the Basher test. The Basher test, he says, is going to reflect what we call intuition. This is the difference between the human being and a computer. You know, a computer can be fabulous at analyzing information. And a computer could be a super genius. You know, but at the end of the day, the computer does not have an intuitive sense. So the paper test could possibly equate man with a computer, but not the Basher test. The Basher test, which is absolutely critical, evokes an intuitive response. Intuitively, do I feel comfortable with this woman? And he says the following. If you've gone out a number of times with a girl and you enjoy the dates, you're feeling warmer and warmer feelings as you develop a relationship. It's going in a positive upswing direction. Then you begin to feel, this is my Basher. You feel comfortable, you look forward, you're excited. Hashem chose this woman for me. In the case of David and Batya, in the second paragraph, on that right column, he says that the paper test has presumably, let's underline that word, checked out. Because again, if he's up to the stage of the Basher test, then it means the paper test has checked out. That's why he agreed to go out with him. Now he hits a snag. Batya's outspoken. David has to ask himself the following question. And there is no rational, intellectual answer to this question. It is intuitive, it's subjective. Can I live with this? Can I feel comfortable with this? He has to go back and ask himself why he feels uncomfortable. And if he can work that through to such an extent that he sees that this is relative to the whole marriage package and the relationship that they want to build, this is secondary. It's not significant. So he'll try to do more research next time he says the Dvar Torah. As Rav Aaron said before, he'll try to look at it from a different perspective, Elu v'Elu. He can work it out. If he can work it out and he gets to the point where he feels comfortable with this girl, and she has all the quality characteristics that he desires in a wife, then he knows that this is his bashar. Interesting. You start with intuition. It goes like this. You start with objective information or knowledge. That's pure brain. You go down to intuitive heart. The heart and the head now are working together in unison. The heart feels a certain barrier here. Wait, there's a problem. In computer terms, call it a glitch. And the question is, can we iron out this glitch? And if we can, then we go back to our sense of bitachon, of relying on Hashem, that Hashem sent me this basher. If David can answer, yes, I'm comfortable with Batya, I enjoy her company, it feels right, then essentially, she's right for him. And that's all he has to know. The basic premise is that Hashem knows what he needs to be happy, and therefore Hashem has presented this woman as his basher to him. All the issues and the conflicts that may arise due to different personality quirks or traits can be worked out. And that's the challenge of the framework of marriage. Hashem puts us into a marriage framework if we've already set up that the paper test is checked out and the basher test is there. Now the rest is we rely on Hashem. We now take an active role in building that relationship, in working out the differences. If the sense is, oh, I can't deal with this, this is too much for me. You know, this woman is argumentative, you know, she wants to combat me. That's not me. I can't live with this. I'm uncomfortable. Then he has to know that she did not pass the basher test. She may have a long list of qualities, but the basher test, she hasn't passed. Now we come to marriage, and he says the same perspective applies to marriage, to married couples. He says, I can't tell you how many times I've heard a husband or wife say anxiously, how do I know that she's the one? Maybe I made a mistake. This is the wrong one. And the answer is that if you did the proper hishtadlus, if you know you did the paper test and the basher test, everything checked out, now this is your responsibility, based on the premise that this is the woman that Hashem intended for you, to work this out, to face the challenges. And all of marriage, all marriages, every marriage has challenges. There's no such thing as a perfect couple. If anybody says to you, we never had any issues in marriage, don't believe them. They're pulling your leg. But at the end of the day, you have to recognize that Hashem knows what's best for you. He's brought you to the right person. Go through a difficult, challenging growth process in order to achieve a successful marriage. And this leads me back to number 5, which is the previous scenario on page 2, which we called Picture Perfect. And you remember that after 3 dates, Shimon is considering getting serious with Chai, but what bothers him? Her appearance. And why is that? Because she's not picture perfect. Let's take a look at page 6. And once again, this should be seen all in one context, in one framework. Physical attraction to one's spouse is important. And it could very well be that Shimon, although he likes Chaya, he got his message not on the level of paper test, but on the level of basher test. He doesn't feel comfortable with her. She doesn't live up to what he had envisioned as picture perfect for a woman to be. But maybe he should be rechecking himself. When he feels intuitively uncomfortable, why is it? What are the underpinnings of his idea of marriage? He says the following. Many times what holds back a person is not the intuitive sense that she's not the right one for me. Again, in that case, then we drop it right away, the basher test was a failure. But rather, he has a notion of what marriage should be. He has this picture of what she should look like, and she's got to look picture perfect. Why? Why does he have that notion? And once again, maybe he should be working this out. Does he want to impress others? Does he want to marry a woman that, you know, he'll feel very comfortable with his friends, and he can impress his parents and so forth and so on, because they put all the emphasis on these superficial ideals?
We said this last week. Trophy wife.
That what?
Trophy wife.
Right, right, correct. The trophy wife. He says if he does honest introspection, he may determine that he wants to marry a girl who will win him, for him, the admiration of his friends and family. And that's something that he has to work on, because are those the hashkafas of his marriage? Is that what finding a marriage partner is all about? To win the admiration of parents? I mean, those might be important elements, but is that the hashkaf of marriage? If it is, then he's saying to the Ribbono Shel Olam, you know, you may have sent me this woman, but I can't be married to her. I'll have to go on and find someone else. In other words, he's going to force his will on the Ribbono Shel Olam. Maybe he could take a step back, introspect, and work on himself, analyze his feelings, and come to the conclusion that, you know what? Ultimately, it's his decision. He's got to marry this woman. And he shouldn't judge by things that are so external. And here's where we have the idea of a basheret. That 40 days before a person is conceived, a bas kol comes out and declares, plonis, bas plonis, ploni leplonis. This is the girl that's designated for this boy. And one of the great mashgichim of the previous generation, Rav Volba, says that this bas kol for us, and it's how do we read the bas kol, how do we hear it, is the sense of intuitive comfort, of feeling that there's a rightness here in this relationship. If Shimon is perfectly comfortable with Chaya, he's worried about what friends and family may say about her, then he has to acknowledge a basic truth. If he gives up on Chaya and insists on pursuing a woman who has this, you know, dream, beauty, perfect vision, then he may actually end up with a different woman and not be happy with her, even if she's absolutely his dream vision. So Shimon really has to discover whether Chaya is right for him. And a lot of this depends on what his vision is for the future. If his vision is based on, as we said before, the externalities of what he thinks will be impressive on others, he's never going to be comfortable with this, and he'll know he can't marry this woman. If on the other hand, he's willing to look at this woman, you know, Chazal say to look at a whole person, and to say, yes, she has everything that I need, and I do like her, and I do feel comfortable, see if he can honestly work this all out. And if he can have a control, so to speak, what we said, head over heart, and he can reorganize what he thinks is the proper hashkafa, how he will ultimately be happy with this girl, then he may indeed marry Chaya and find that he's happily married. And here I want to refer you to number 7, which is on page 2. And in number 7, there are two different scenarios. Two young women who were very, very close friends, Rina and Toby. And Rina went first, so to speak. And what did she do? She met a guy named Ephraim. He was handsome, right? He was just this dashing young man, bright. He went to the finest yeshiva. He was considered the top guy in the yeshiva. You know, everybody tells you this guy's the best guy in Lakewood. Have you ever heard that phrase? It's like a phrase in America. The top guy in Lakewood, you know. But there's so many top guys in Lakewood. After all, anyway. He's successful. He's charismatic. You know, he gets up. He's the guy at the party, you know, puts it all together. And she's very impressed with him. He proposes to her, and guess what? She's just tickled pink. She's uplifted. I mean, look at this opportunity. She's the luckiest woman in the world. Unfortunately, after a couple of years of marriage, she finds out more about Ephraim. A lot of that externalities was just superficial. Instead, he's self-centered. He's not giving. Doesn't want to build a relationship by trying to give to his wife. He's unwilling to improve. You remember on the bottom of page 6 that we wanted to sign a document. You know, you got to be willing to improve, to change. And whenever she tries to bring up in conversation, you know, to confront him in a nice way with how can we develop this relationship, he's not willing to budge. He keeps saying, you can't change me. This is what I am. And here's where she feels very stuck in a marriage. Her close friend Toby learned from the fiasco, so to speak, of her friend Rena. She married a man who, in her own words, was nice looking enough. You know, he wasn't dashing, he wasn't charismatic, he wasn't Mr. Universe, but, you know, he was good. In Yiddish we say, nishkasha. Yeah. He had a smaller income, you know, because he wasn't the top guy financially, this and that, but he had a big heart, loving, caring, with a tremendous desire to grow and to give. And 10 years later, she still feels how lucky she is to find him. So it's interesting to see these two scenarios. And I think if we put this together with the picture perfect scenario, what we're trying to create here is a fascinating, I call it a new approach, or at least a new formulation to dating and marriage. Dating and marriage is not all about these first impressions. It's not all about, you know, being swept off my feet by who the guy is. And again, the trouble is that we live in this society, in this contemporary Western society, which puts so much emphasis on these internal things with the goal to be, you know, wow, I feel so lucky, I feel so swept. You know, I walk down the street and like, she's a model, she's an actress, you know. This is what I feel I want to show off with. You know, that's the girl who's going to make you happy in marriage. So look deeper, look below the surface. Look and try to determine the qualities, the goals. I want to share with you two other points from Rabbi Schaefer that I found very interesting, part of this larger article that was published in Mishpacha magazine. First of all, he, as I told you before, he has a lot of experience with couples, and a newly married fellow called me up. He was very distraught. What should he do? His wife wears skirts that barely cover her knees. Okay? This is the issue. You may laugh at it, but it's a serious issue. You know, it could really rip the heart. This is painful. Yeah, he doesn't want a woman who dresses in that way. Now again, in this case, he says it barely covers her knees. That doesn't sound so terrible, you know, but again, it could have been a lot worse. What should I tell him? What should I do in this situation? So if you take a look at what the rabbi has to say, this is very interesting. This is on the top of page 8. The rabbi says the following. Your wife went to 12 years, she went through 12 years of Beis Yaakov education. Okay? You think she doesn't know what this is all about? If you say something, she'll feel awful and you'll damage your relationship with her. That's interesting, no? Here's a man who has an honest to goodness, objective, true claim. You know, he has an argument here. It's not that he's falsifying something. But no, it might hurt her feelings. Interesting. Interesting way of looking at things. Instead, say not a word and just work on your marriage. As a result, she'll become more secure, more confident in the marriage, she'll feel stronger, she'll be able to resist social pressure, and the skirts will get longer. Interesting, no? What do you say,
Shane? May I say something?
Please.
2 or 3. First of all, it sounds very much that you're talking about California now.
That's interesting. I thought we were talking about New York.
Well, part of New York also, but California, yeah. You know, that's the scene, even in Hasidic settings. I think that the man could bring home a few pairs of very nice tights. Who's laughing?
You think she'll wear them?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
For Kelly?
Tights and boots.
You can go shopping for her.
No, I mean, like, not just to bring home a tinsel, but also to bring home some really, you know, snazzy tights and boots. She'll wear them. And I think she's going to hear the message a little bit that we've got to do a little bit more.
I think what the rabbi is saying is that wait a while and then buy the tights.
Yeah, but he, you know.
Ultimately, you're right. He has to buy the tights.
He has to buy the tights. Yeah. You know.
He should buy the most expensive tights to make her feel wow, you know. But but that has to come with a little bit of time.
Yeah.
Work on the marriage. In other words, it's interesting. Rabbi Schaefer is saying something that's very profound, though, very deep. And you can either buy in or leave it out. And it probably there's no universal absolute rule about this. But he's saying that what you're seeing here is a result of this woman's conflict. She's conflicted. She has a marriage relationship and she has society. In this case, there is a head-on collision. And my friends, this is so common. Mm-hmm. Because we live in a society which has antithetical values to Torah. We don't live in Williamsburg and Borough Park. So therefore, what does she do? She's being pulled in two different directions. And the answer is, in any seesaw, the stronger, the weightier side wins out. As if the root of the problem is that her marriage relationship is not solid, then for sure the first thing she's going to give up is tzniyus because she lives in a society where she wants to impress everyone. Everyone looks this way, everyone's wearing the minis and all this stuff. She wants to do the same. So he says, if that be the case, then the stronger the relationship, the more easy it will be for her, because of that loving, warm relationship in which she feels secure, to drop society in favor of the values of the world.
She's also getting attention.
Can they just communicate sometimes? Right. Because that's also why you build relationships, when you communicate that you feel.
Again, if the root of the problem.
That was the root of the problem.
Right. Again, that's going to come later, but he's saying if the root of the problem is that the relationship is not solid rock, you know, then at this point, to confront her directly. Which again, in most issues in marriage, absolutely. You know, we discussed the great length, all the resolution methodologies, you know, create the right ambiance, it's got to be quiet, there's got to be parroting, you know, we talk back and forth, the whole 9 yards. But in such a sensitive issue, which might be indicative of a lower development of the, you know, it's not a solid relationship, the first thing to work on is the marriage. And after that, you buy the tights and you tell her straight up. And, you know. But again, you know, now look, your approach, I think, would be absolutely appropriate if she has no background.
Right.
You know, let's say she didn't learn in Beis Yaakov for 12 years. Not every woman that every man marries has a Beis Yaakov background. You know, if she didn't have, you know, then he has. Again, why this is coming up in marriage is a question. You know, these issues should come up way earlier. And the fact that it comes up now might be indicative of a kind of deterioration in the marriage relationship. In any event, what I found absolutely fascinating at this little teeny paragraph here are these two points. Number one, be very careful about what you say to your wife or what you say to your husband. There are sensitivities here which early in the marriage, or at least during certain critical periods in the marriage, when there's sensitivity and things are a bit shaky because we face these challenges, it's natural, it's to be anticipated. That's not the right time to go for the jugular, because what you end up doing is you're going to put the other person on defensive, and then, you know, all the fights ensues. We discussed this at many occasions. And people take things out, and then it gets angry, and, you know, I have to defend me, you have to defend you, and this and that. My parents are this, your parents are that. Yeah. Oh, you know, before you know it, it's the whole avalanche, you know. Every single issue that ever came up in marriage all of a sudden spills out, you know, like a balloon that all the air is let out. So you've got, at those sensitive moments, you've got to work on the marriage, which means to reach out. Admiration, caring, sensitivity, what are your needs, how do we build together, create that framework of we're working together as a team. And then once there's a solid relationship, and this is his second point, I think, which is phenomenal, is then you won't even have to go through the chances. You won't even have to go through the motions of pitching the ball. It's gonna happen spontaneously because she has the background. What you should do in a case where she doesn't have the background or he doesn't have the background, whatever it might be, that we'll talk about in a minute. I don't know. It's not clear from the story. You know, every story has a million and one. Right. I have two questions. If she came into the marriage like that, it's very odd that, you know, he's coming to his rabbi. Oh, rabbi, look what I'm, you know, like, what were you thinking? You know. And secondly, the very fact that the rabbi indicates that they're at a sensitive juncture in the marriage, and that her insecurity in the marriage is what's engendering this, I think that also is a bit indicative. But again, whatever the case may be, what should be, if this is the way she presents herself from the get-go, in other words, if he knew about this, that's a whole different story, which we want to talk about. What do you say, Tom? A little.
They wouldn't have gotten married if it was presented before the marriage because we're different.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I want to get to.
I mean, girls have different skirts. I mean, some could be this length, some could be that. So, I mean, we're talking about like an inch skirts above the knee, an inch below. She could have this and that. Maybe she's choosing to wear a lot more of these skirts rather than those skirts.
Right. No, but the only thing is that when you say an inch this way, an inch that way, you know, a girl from a Beis Yaakov background knows exactly that the knee has to be covered. You know, again, an inch below the knee or 2 inches below the knee, that you could argue about. But certainly the knees are covered. I mean, that's like basic.
Right.
Because, you know, from a perspective of the Beis Yaakov education, I happen to know because I have three daughters who went through that system, I can tell you that the knee itself is considered a makom mechusa. Makom mechusa means something that's normally covered and therefore has to be covered. So again, if he knew this going into the marriage, that's going to be something that we'll discuss as we go along. Sharon, you were talking before and I sort of...
No. Yeah. I just a little humor in this.
Right. Okay, good.
The sheitlach are becoming more expensive. Thousands and thousands of dollars were beautiful.
Custom made.
Beautiful sheitlach. The skirts are staying short. Okay? This is something, it's like a trend. I don't know how long, you know, this trend is going to be. It's a current trend. I mentioned California because Hasidic guys are, with beards and everything, are walking around in jeans. And they're walking around in flip-flops and things, right? And yes, it's like a norm of look in the middle of the week.
San Francisco, Pico Roberts.
Yeah.
Pico Roberts, and that's what I'm
What's wrong with the
All the girls now, Roberts. Like...
I don't know.
It's the norm to wear, like, no, the knee is debatable. We learned that.
Yeah, open toe sandals.
We'll have to call the principal of the Beis Yaakov in Los Angeles if I get to the bottom of this.
Or
the top of this. I don't know.
He won't because he has a wife and daughters. You know what he's doing.
I see Beis Yaakov.
A little loud, I don't hear you.
Is that what's going on right now? It's just like that.
Correct.
Yeah, you'll, I mean, I can't get a girl who wears red.
Rabbi Shemsov, yeah. All the girls who are working next door in the Ganon, all of them are from girls. The skirts are somewhere between the knee and the ankle. And sneus is like observed by the whole staff. So, you know what?
That's good to know in case I need to find a gun for my grandchild. I don't have to send him or her too far. I mean,
right here. So sneus is live and well. You know what?
Before we go on, and I have a lot more to talk to you about tonight, and before we say goodbye, so to speak, to Rabbi Shafir. They asked him, and this is on page 8, why we are seeing, in his opinion, more divorces today in the Orthodox circles than we saw in previous years. And he gives three answers, which I wanted to share with you and maybe get your input. He says, number one, people are more fragile today. In other words, he's talking about the whole psychological makeup of a human being. And he claims that modernity has engendered a certain, he calls it, a lack of wholesomeness. A sense of being comfortable with who they are, what they stand for, how they fit into the world. Maybe he may be comparing and contrasting our generation to generations bygone, in the more simplistic, if I could use that word, not in a pejorative way, you know, shtetl kind of life, where you knew more or less who you were, what your place was within society. Today it's immensely more complicated to find your way through this whole maze. Who am I? You know, to answer the question, who am I, has become so complex. You know, we're hit with so many different things in terms of society and its values and where we can contribute, how to get into the financial market. You know, back in the shtetl where my father came from 100 years ago, if my father were alive today, he'd be 101.
Wow.
Yeah, this would have been his 101st birthday.
Amazing.
But, basically the issues were, you know, we're going to be a milkman, whether you're going to be a tailor. You know, there were a limited amount of decisions to be made. And you didn't really have to fight your way through. You know, you knew you were going to make a couple of rubles and that was it. And you didn't have any fancy. But now it's very complicated. And when these factors, these psychological issues that people struggle with today are brought to marriage, it creates a challenge to the goal of creating a healthy relationship. Because he writes, and this is very fascinating, a healthy relationship requires a solid, healthy human being. Now, before we look for a marriage partner, we have to ask ourselves, who are we? Who am I? Am I ready to make this leap? Do I have a personality? Do I have something to contribute? Love my neighbor like you love yourself, but you have to first love yourself. There's got to be a self-image here. Mm-hmm. And there's so many insecurities in the modern person, and all these kick in to marriage. He writes that marriage requires a lot of give and take, flexibility. You've got to also have reasonable expectations in a marriage. If you yourself are fighting constantly with barriers, emotional, psychological, social, then it's very difficult for you to be coming to the marriage table and bringing and giving. Number two, he says society puts the emphasis today on commercialism. He says this is a big factor in divorce today. You know, we have a sense of, I buy something and if it works, great. But, you know, if I get sick of it, I just throw it out. Everything's disposable. You know, we live in the age of disposable. Everything, you know, everything's disposable, right? So marriage becomes a commodity that's disposable in today's culture. There's no absolute commitment. I'm going to make this work. You know, this is my basheret. She passed all the tests. God sent it to me. No. I'm going to chew things up and spit them out. So 20 years ago, he says, the question would be, if there was conflict in marriage, can we save the marriage? How do we save the marriage? Today the question is, should we bother saving the marriage? In other words, divorce is so acceptable. He tells a story, he spent 2.5 hours with a woman trying to convince her that her marriage could not only be saved, but that, you know, with effort, they could become happily married. And she calls me back to tell me, nope, I want out, it's just not worth it. What do you mean it's not worth it? You know, it's just like not worth the effort. And what a tragedy. He says it was the first time in recent history, he says, that I broke down crying. He says the third and perhaps most popular issue that he identifies in marriage is, he says that we don't have enough time and concentration to focus on anything, let alone our own marriage. He says 10 years ago, we were called a busy generation. But that label is already outdated because today we call ourselves the distracted generation. We're totally distracted. He talks about texting. You know, when I taught in yeshiva in Mevaseret, you know, we used to in when we started the yeshiva 20 years ago, every shiur was an hour. And then we realized that the guys can't concentrate for an hour. You know, they just, the brain is just, you know, mashed potatoes. Yeah, everybody's ADD today. I mean, anyone who's not ADD is probably 50 years old or more. So what's going on? You can't get people to focus. He says that has a tremendously detrimental effect on marriage. He says what happens in marriage is that by the time the kids are school age, the couple spends no time together at all. This is what we discussed last time about the significance of finding, carving out time. It shouldn't be ships passing through the night. He says, log how much time you spend as a couple. That should be logged in. It should be in the computer, in the schedule. And enjoy each other's company. Spend quality time together. Turn off the BlackBerry. He says, a marriage by definition is a relationship built on love and affection, on common identity. That's asking a lot. That's an uphill battle. That doesn't just come. It doesn't fall into your hands. If you're not going to work on the marriage, then the bonds start to weaken and they drift away, one from each other, he from her and her from him. So again, we got to start with this initial excitement in marriage that we have. You know, we have the love and the affection and the ideal, and we're in a romantic mood. But there's a whole lifetime of sustaining those intense feelings. He says what happens is couples begin bickering, and it's a result of the fact that their connections wane. They're weak. You know, within a solid framework of a close relationship, you know, people who spend time together and work on their marriage together, it's a lot easier to face these issues. He says if they'll bicker before the connections wane, they're in a better position than couples who don't bicker at all simply because they're strangers. Because at least in the former case, there's a wake-up call. You know, they realize, hey, wait a minute, our relationship is beginning to die down a little. The flame, the embers are low. Let's work on it. Let's fan the flames. Let's get back on track. Let's develop an intensity. So that was a wake-up call. In the second case, they're already strangers. I just had a couple here married 30-something years and they want to get divorced because they have no emotional connection.
Jeez.
Isn't that tragic? 30 years of marriage. They share a house, bills, and kids, but nothing else. That's what happens when you spend zero special time together. So again, the rabbi is making a tremendous pitch for developing the relationship, the love, the affection, spending time together, quality time together. All the old stuff that we did in the dating period and Shana Rishona, the first year of marriage, all that has to go on and continue, never to be taken for granted. And it becomes more and more of a challenge as married life goes on, because we take upon ourselves more and more responsibilities, more jobs. You remember the scenario we had with that kolnik who learns in two kolils and he tutors at night. His wife is taking care of a one-year-old baby, plus she took on a job. She's trying to run the house. She's exhausted. He's not even there to be exhausted with her. They don't even fall, you know, collapse on the couch together. There's no quality time together. It's tragic. 30 years of marriage and divorce. So again, the atmosphere that we live in today makes it particularly challenging to achieve a successful marriage, but we have to work on it. One of the issues in marriage that we've mentioned, but we never really tackled it head on, is anger. And if you take a look at Rabbi Feldman in his book, The River, the Kettle, and the Bird, on pages 9 and 10 in your handout, he offers a number of suggestions as to how to deal with anger. He speaks about, first of all, the technique of silence. We once mentioned that Rav Baruch Ber, the great Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, had a special hat that he would wear when he got angry. So as soon as he got angry, he said, "Give me that hat." You know, and his wife would sometimes hide it. This was the delay action. You know, try to wait anger out. You know, if you wait 15 minutes, even better, a full day, get busy with something else, then invariably you'll have a different perspective on what you get angry about. He says if you absolutely must give voice to your anger, do it in solitude. This is like almost a what's it called in Chassidus? Yeah, but what kind of chesedus are you talking about? Bretzel, right. It's almost a Bretzel approach. See, Bretzel works on anger a lot. I mean, I'm not a Bretzel, but I know this from whatever I've read. Anger is considered enemy number one. And the truth is, anger is enemy number one. Because anger is like avodah zarah, which means that you lose total mental control. The brain is totally dead. And once anger sets in, it's like an avalanche. You know, it gets heavier and heavier, and who knows, chashom, where it could lead. And in front of the children, it's the worst. So he says the first thing is lock yourself up in a room, a place where you can shout. He says do this in front of a mirror, because a man's face, a woman's face, anyone's face, you know, when they get angry, is absolutely repulsive. You know, it's disgusting. And as soon as you listen and watch yourself get angry and fulminate, that's an interesting word, this will help diffuse your anger. No one respects an angry man, least of all yourself. So looking into the mirror, that's gonna calm you down. You may even start laughing at yourself at some point. Then he goes on in the next paragraph, and he offers another suggestion. He says that in a certain department store, when they get calls from clients who are upset, you know, with complaints, what they do is the individual whose job it was to handle the complaints was trained to ask her caller if he or she would kindly repeat what he or she said, because I didn't get it straight the first time. The caller would repeat his or her complaint. But usually by the second round, they tone down the voice of anger. The next step in that company was to transfer the call to another operator who would ask the person to repeat his complaint. This is for the third time.
And they're less angry.
I don't know. You're right. I don't know. I'm sure that they, you know, they had some sort of feedback. How do you say, you know, that they checked it out to see. He says, by this time, the caller had lost most of his heat.
Oh my goodness.
And the apology offered by the telephone operator was generally sufficient. Okay, so number one, delay weakens anger. Hearing oneself get angry makes one feel a little bit silly. Most people would prefer to stop arguing rather than relive the experience and sound a little bit like a fool. I don't know. I think you're right, Yitz. In some cases, it's just going to get you more and more angry.
It's not going to work.
Yeah.
So I don't know, you know, he doesn't tell you which company it was and what the, you know, what the scientific experiment, you know, what were the results.
Not valid, whatever.
Then he goes on to say the following. Even more effective than all these ploys is to think about one's obligation as an Oved Hashem, as a Torah Jew. And again, you know, the Bali Musar speak about the fact that we have to constantly review all the time. The Ramchal in his introduction, I mentioned it more than once. Constant awareness. The Torah forbids anger. Again, you're allowed to get angry at someone if you're building him up, but again, that's controlled anger. You're allowed to get angry at a child who's crossing the street without waiting for the light to change. But anger precipitates innumerable violations of Torah law. Lo sonu ishus hamito, v'yavtu rech kamocha, and many more. Therefore, Jews committed to Torah, who has an urge to get angry, should try to imagine that he has in front of him macholas asuros. He's got bus macholas in front of him. He says, would he consider eating this mixture? The transgression of becoming angry is more serious than eating bus macholas. That's a pretty heavy statement. Why should one be willing to violate one transgression and not the other? You're not willing to violate bus macholas. You know, you're not eating tarfus. So why are you getting angry? And he says, picture yourself as if it was Erev Yom Kippur and you're coming to beg forgiveness. In this case, instead of begging forgiveness from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, first and foremost, beg your wife's forgiveness for all the times that you offended her. And again, as I said in Breslov, the key to marital happiness and Shalom Bayis is the responsibilities in the hands of the husband. Again, Rabbi Feldman wrote this book addressing the men because he was writing it for his students. God's own way of loving man Now, why don't we think about HaKadosh Baruch Hu? We want to imitate Hashem. This is the moral rule, you know, the most important rule in Jewish ethics is imitate God. What do we say about God? Berogez rachem tizkar. Even at the moment that God is angry, he reminds himself of his mercy. That's an unbelievable thing. But am I God? But yet, maybe I should try to imitate God. I'm angry at my wife. Remind myself of my love for her. You know, judge her favorably. Okay, maybe in your mind at least, okay, she'll probably have a different perspective on it if you give her a chance to explain herself, but in your mind, she messed up bad, right? And she insulted you, and you feel down, and you know, people are sensitive. It's like, you know, stepping on a red toe, you know, that's very injured, and you hit the ceiling, and you react by bursting out with anger. Try to calm down. Recall the moments that they have together. Think of her in a broader picture. Again, once he's in the clutches of anger, it's too late for this. You know, there's that split second before he crosses the threshold into angry mode. That's when he can get a control of himself. After that, it's already too late. The best thing he can hope for is that at some point in his anger, he'll calm down. Or maybe he can run away, put on that dunce hat, lock himself up, stand in front of a mirror and laugh at himself. But that's going to be a superhuman effort. So that's why the constant reminder about how terrible anger is and how many violations and how it's against all of Jewish ethics. If anger still cannot be contained, one should at the very least follow Hillel's example, who says, speak in a calm voice. At least try to control the volume of your voice, at the very least. That's not easy, but it can be done. A calm voice removes anger. That's what Shlomo HaMelech said. Okay. Now, I want to talk to you, how are we doing on the clock? Good, we're good. Dating for marriage. Okay? Keep page 11 handy, and I want to say the following. The first rule in dating for marriage is to invest in finding your Bashet. Your Bashet will not just fly down from Shammai. You know, Yitzhak was very lucky when Eliezer found Rivka and brought it to him, but we're not all that, you know, on that level. You know, so let's be straight about it. What it means to invest is both in the head and in the heart. You're going to have to think about the possible suggestion, you know, the person who's being suggested to you, think it out with your head. Does he or she have the qualities that you're looking for? Okay? I want to share with you the following scenario. Okay? Jay has been dating Melissa for months and months. Let's talk about Jay first. Jay is a medical student. He's halfway through med school. He was brought up in a very wealthy family in suburbia. He had everything materialistically that he needed. But he became an idealist. And his goal is to become a physician and go out to, I don't know, Vietnam or to somewhere in Africa and save, you know, third world. Melissa is just the opposite. She comes from a family which struggled to put food on the table. She herself always struggled. She took out student loans. She worked overtime to support herself through high school, through college. She can't afford to go to Africa. What she's thinking about, she has no desire to save the people in the third world. What she wants to do is get a good job, live in suburbia, have all the comforts that she never had as a child, be close to her parents, and she's the exact opposite of Jay. Jay is independent of his parents. They gave him, you know, they raised him with a silver spoon in his mouth. He wants to break away from that. He wants to go down into the trenches and save the Africans. Jay, why did it take you months and months to figure this out? This girl is not for you. So Jay says, I found this all out on the fourth date. They've been dating for almost a year, a half a year or more. After the fourth date, like, buddy, where are you? Didn't you figure it out in your head? This is not going to work. He says, no. Why? We always wanted to give it a chance. We thought it would work out. That relationship was developing nicely. It deepened. And we believed, and you may have heard this phrase before, love would conquer all. It's not realistic, my friends. Love cannot conquer these deep-seated divisions. He should have done this research beforehand. He knows what he has to come to the table with, what his vision is, what his goals are in life. He understands what she's interested in, where she's going. This is not a relationship. You go out with a girl, and you find out that she wants to live in California. You want to live in Yerushalayim. You know, there's just no way this is going to work out. You know, sometimes you find someone who says, you know, I want to live in America, but I want to make Aliyah. All right, that's a start. I know my wife and I, when somebody suggested that we go out, and I was listening a little bit with a half an ear, because the woman who was suggesting it really didn't come from the same kind of background and share the same ideals. But all of a sudden, midway through the conversation, she says she only wants to marry a guy who wants to live in Israel. I said, let's start from the beginning. Tell me everything again. And now I was listening. And that's what made the difference. Right. You know, this guy wants to learn Torah full time, wants to marry a woman who will support him, right? Because he needs a financial stability. She doesn't have the least of an inclination to support her husband. I mean, you know, these are things he can't work out. You know, she wants to live in one part of the world, he in the other. That's, you know, all this should be done right up front, even before he meets her and she meets him. And as we said before, if she wants to wear miniskirts and he wants to wear skirts below the knees, this is just not going to go. You know, that's why we said before that sometimes these issues develop down the line because of insecurity. Even when compromises are made, we should realize, again, going into the dating, that if we're going to bank on compromises are, you know, they take a toll. They tend to chip away at a marriage relationship. Because often within a compromise, she's not happy with the compromise, he's not happy. That's not the way to build a relationship. And therefore, there are things that can be negotiated. There are compromises that can be made. For example, I know a couple that he must go to sleep at night with the television on. She can't fall asleep with the television on. Okay, this has to be worked out. She wants the window open at night, because she's Israeli. And he wants to close the window. You know, he's a chutznik. You know, this could be a problem, but, you know, these are things you could compromise on. Maybe, you know, Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays, whatever. You know, they have problems about spending the money. You know, how much money should they spend? These are things that you can find compromises on. But you cannot compromise on basic beliefs, on basic aspirations. What is your goal in life? Who are you?
People don't know.
People don't know. And that's why, in preparing for marriage, this is where the emphasis should be. Does she share aspirations with me? If I want to sit and learn for the rest of my life, I want to know if she wants to marry a guy like that. If she wants to marry someone who's going to be, you know, the greatest financial trader on Wall Street, you know, he has to fit into that picture. If, on the other hand, they have shared aspirations, beliefs, values, their priority system is in tune, they have shared goals and aspirations, that's a basis for marriage. So we spoke about before, in Rabbi Schaefer's language, the paper test and then the Bashar test. The paper test should check out before the couple gets there. That's head before heart. That's the references that we have to find. The research that we have to do, and this can be done. Ah, now we've passed the paper test. We're on the same boat. We want to live in the same country. We have basic goals in common. Now, let's meet. Let's see if we can develop admiration, respect. If we are comfortable with each other, we like each other, we develop a closeness, a relationship. Every date is intense. Every date is more fun. I look forward to the next date. Now I'm on to the Bashar test. But don't get involved in a relationship when you're worlds apart. Don't jump in and think, I'm going to change this fellow. Yeah. I'm going to make compromises. He's going to make compromises. No, that's not the way to do it. Intelligent dating. Four elements to intelligent dating. Number one, know who you are, what you bring to the table, and where you're heading. What kind of person do you want to marry? What are your negotiables and what are not? Number two, someone who is suggesting that you go out with a certain young lady, we'll call it the Shaktan Shaktanta, should be a wise person. I know a person, a rabbi, who had two Rolodexes, this is a true story, one for the boys, one for the girls, wherever it landed, that's where he made a shidduch.
Oh.
Okay, so once in a while it worked. You know, out of 4,000 shiras, he made 10 shidduchim. But try to find someone who's at least fairly wise. Someone who could be a relative, a friend. Friends are great. A young married couple, that's the best. She's got her friends that she could suggest for you. He's got his friends to suggest for you. And not only that, the person who sets you up, whether it's a family member, whether it's a friend, a member of the community, whoever it is, should play an active role. Let them do some research. Let them tell you what you're getting into here. Number three, that person who connects you should have insights. They should, from time to time, get the feedback and give you, you know how often it is that a boy or a girl, they go out on a date and you call up the boy, again, it could be the reverse, I'm just giving one scenario, and you ask him, well, what'd you think? Nice girl, but she didn't stop talking.
That's good.
The Tesha Kavim, you know.
Very.
If anyone knows what I'm referring to. Right? So she talks and she talks. So the Shadchan could say the following. Again, if it's true, we're trying to base this marriage on truth. So the Shadchan could say, look, maybe she was very nervous. And then the Shadchan could get back to the girl and say, what happened? She had diarrhea in the mouth. She just couldn't stop talking. She was so nervous. You know, because sometimes in dating, the worst thing that can happen is silence. Well, that's not necessarily true. Silence is golden as well. The second date, they get together, it's a whole different story. By the third date, they're conversing freely and it's flowing and it's wonderful. Another situation where the Shadchan can play an active role and straighten things out. Yeah, he comes to the date and he talks about Torah, which is wonderful, but that's, you know, he's got a whole list of different Torah that he wants to share with her. Now, very often, he doesn't realize, especially if he's new at dating and he's not experienced, you know what the Shadchan, I think this is the rule of thumb in most cases, again from my humble, limited experience, tell the guy to share with her things about himself.
Right, that's tough.
Do you know what happens? Frequently, a couple is dating for months and he never told her that he lost a brother to Rabbanu Litzlin. He never shared with her something emotional. That is back. He was afraid, he was embarrassed, whatever it might be. If these things are shared, there's an openness that automatically creates a connection. So it's really wonderful that he talks about the sports scores or Lahavdalol Fagdol's, the Torah that he wants to share with her, but she's not getting a vision of who he is. And therefore she's not, he loved Kasheret, you know, there's no Kesher, there's no connection. They're not building a close, intimate relationship. Number four, Shmirat Negiah. No, it has to be said and put on the table. Because if the physical bond is already there, then the heart is already in control. The head is not going to function. The beauty of religious Torah observant dating is that the sexual intimacy is going to come later, after marriage. If it comes too early, then it's going to just cloud the mind. Let's develop a relationship that's built on shared midos, seeing the beauty of a person. And therefore, if a person is dating, his connection should be a personal connection, not a physical connection. Physical attraction is important, but the connection has to be person to person. You know, sometimes in dating, what you find is that, you know, a girl will feel about him or she or he about her that, you know, they're going to change. You know, I want you to take a look at page 11. Page 11, I think I mentioned last time. comes from a wonderful, wonderful, very, in my opinion, very highly recommended book by Gila Mandelson.
Yeah.
I've read some of our other books. This is the best, in my opinion. You know, you can start with this one. I'm saving you a lot of time and maybe money, I don't know. What you want to know before dating a marriage, head to heart. So I took a few paragraphs and I, you know, cut and pasted them together here on page 11. Fine. She writes, I know couples who are happily married because one partner's willingness to see if the other would grow on her or him. Instead of this immediate first impression, you know, I got to see it right away. You know, the elephants have to roll around my eyeballs. You know, is he Prince John and get off the white horse? I think the women have more of a problem with this than the men do. I mean, that's antithetical to everything we've been taught to believe in Western society, but I think that's the problem. So women reject someone because the appearance is not exactly what she expected. But give it a chance. Are there times that you're attracted to this person? And why? And if a woman will give that little extra rope, she'll be attracted to him if she feels that he is a tremendous person with great sterling midos. If she can see that. Sometimes on Purim it comes out, by the way.
Last night, brother.
Yeah, that's right. Don't measure your date against some preconceived vision. Try to view him without prejudice. Come to appreciate his or her beauty in terms of personality colors. Keep in mind that your spouse may bear no resemblance to that person that you've imagined, or even to the person that you dated. We change, we get older, you know, the everything shrinks and we get lines, we get white, this is the way. But the marriage has to be for all time. Therefore, the most important attraction has to be personal, has to be person to person, as we said before. When I was a kid, you know, you used to make a long distance phone call, you paid more if you wanted to be person to person. That's the key to marriage. Dating has to be to create and engender a person-to-person relationship, an emotional attraction. It takes time. You have to see the person for who they are. And now she gives the following story. 3/4 of an hour into the date, Yaakov offers to walk Aviva home. Listen, I want to be straight with you. You're not for me. 45 minutes, you're not for me. Again, this is assuming that she passed the paper test, right? So it took them 45 minutes to determine that she's not for
chemistry.
So chemistry, right? Aviva felt no interest in him either. Well, maybe because, well, whatever. And she was actually ticked off, and she decided to let him have it. Maybe he'll learn something for the next date with the next girl. She says to him, I couldn't care less whether we go out again, isolate, right? But you should know that I don't think you know me after 45 minutes. That's ridiculous. And that's shallow. And that engendered a whole conversation. They started fighting with each other. An hour-long conversation ensued. And each person was impressed with the other's willingness to communicate directly and honestly. That's right. Today they have an excellent marriage.
Wow.
Very strange story. But even if the story is as rare as, you know, the man on the moon, but it still indicates something. You know, why did the guy think 45 minutes, that's it. She's not for me.
She wasn't opening up. Because it was the
45 time. Minutes, Tom.
She was nervous.
Give it a little time. It's like 45 minutes. You know, that's enough time to, you know, to get onto the train and get off the train. You know, that's about it. Likewise, don't write off a person for doing something stupid. Right? Young women have asked me, how should I react to the fact that at 11:30 at night, my date said goodbye to me and left me alone at a bus stop? You know, I would have said, drop my hot potato.
No, that's wrong.
But she says, wait a minute, this was his first date. Maybe he was ignorant. Go out again and bring it up with him. Interesting. Here's your approach. Really, absolutely straightforward and honest. If he comes forward with a sincere apology, and he says, I must change. That says a lot about his character. And he doesn't repeat his mistake. Again, this kind of scenario is very tricky. Be very careful, because sometimes, you know, if a man, for example, is stingy on a date, that should send off, you know, red bells. you know, instead of buying you a coffee for you know, well, I don't know what a coffee costs today. My day was a quarter, you know. No, but he doesn't want to spend money on a coffee, right? Yeah, too much to spend on a coffee, you know what I'm saying? Or he says that you pay for your own train ride. You know, like, if he's ridiculously stingy, I would say that's a red belt, you know. But sometimes he does something stupid, or she does something stupid, and, you know, give it a second chance. Sometimes you can sense that a relationship is developing. So get, you know, now you should lengthen your dates. The first dates should be short, 2 hours, that's enough. You should see each other once a week, twice a week, not too often. Brief phone calls in between dates, take it slowly. This is very important for girls also, because girls need to see how the relationship is developing over the course of time. As things become more serious, you need to feel how much you miss him or you don't miss him. The space is important. Space out your dates. This is spacing, family spacing in dating, right? And what should you do on these dates? You know what? Artificial. At the beginning, just skirt through, spend time together, spend company together, see if you feel comfortable, do things together, informal, fun, go to a park, go for a walk, encourage each other and yourselves to feel relaxed. Avoid overly romantic environments at the beginning. You want to remain head first, objective as possible. Pay attention to subtleties. This is the most important rule that you can give on dating. Look around, be observant. You know, she's observing you, you should observe her too. There are certain subtleties that are reflections of personality. Look at the way he drives. If he's very aggressive on the road or he's very nervous, that speaks volumes. If he double parks or he parks in a way that he closes somebody out, you know, or if he reverses and scratches the next car and does nothing, you know, that's observe how she relates to others. Okay, Purim. Here's Purim. I was coming to Purim. Yeah. Note how she reacts to frustrations. If she misses a bus, she can't find an empty table at a restaurant, does she just break down or blow up? One couple I knew were caught in a downpour, and the woman's easygoing, playful reaction to getting drenched propelled her date towards deciding that she's the one. I know of a case of someone who decided to marry his wife because after traveling for 2.5 hours to a concert in Brooklyn College, Walt Whitman Auditorium, for those who are familiar, and they only found out that after this whole schlep, that he had made a mistake.
On the day.
on the day, and the concert was tomorrow. And she said, I didn't want to go to a concert. That's when he decided that he wants to marry her. It's like Yitzhak and Rivka, Eliezer and Rivka. Watch how she deals with disagreements. Or watch how he airs his opinion. Does he respect yours? Does he work things out maturely? Does he try to resolve conflicts? Can she take criticism if it's done in the proper way? Can he forgo having the last word in a debate? See what things make her happy, make her sad, make her excited, make her upset. Introduce him to people that you know. Ask for their impressions. Sometimes you're too involved and subjective to get an objective view. You need someone who stands at a distance. Meet his friends and get an idea who he hangs around with. The company one keeps says a lot. Blinetta will pick this up again next week, try to get into more nitty-gritty details about dating and finding a marriage.
Oh, guys, you can stick around for Mari.
Thank you so much.
Is that last
thing?
What do you say?
To judge a man by the company he keeps.
Let's see your friend.
For lack of a better term.
Is it fair to get...
Exactly. Hopefully you'll meet some of his more uplifting friends, you know. If all he has is imbeciles as friends, I don't know, that's something that has to be thought about. Maybe the shotgun can help you in that case. Like, why is this guy only hanging around with, retards?
Right.
If on the other hand he's trying to, he's trying to give to them. You know, this guy is, he's a camp Simcha guy, and that's his greatness, that's his best. A man may hang out with non-religious people because he's trying to have an impact on them. You know, maybe under certain circumstances, that could be a milah, not a chisaron, positive evidence.
Is this for 18-year-olds?
No, nothing here is for 18-year-olds. 18-year-olds need a separate class. And I would probably encourage them to wait a few years.
To wait a few years, right?
Right.